Welcome to the My Buddy Green podcast. I'm Jason Wachob, founder and co-CEO of My Buddy Green, and your host. Dr. Ethan Weiss is an associate professor of cardiovascular research at UCSF. He received his MD from Johns Hopkins, and his special interests include preventive cardiology, genetics of coronary disease, risk assessment, and heart disease in the young. He's also the co-founder of Keto, that's K-E-Y-T-O, a plant-based approach to keto and weight loss. When it comes to all things heart health, he's one of the best. Ethan, welcome.
Thank you.
It is so great to have you here. I'm a huge fan of all your work, so it's about time.
Well, I appreciate it. Thank you. I know I had a couple of misfires trying to get here. It took me, I think this was our third time. I felt bad.
Third time's a charm.
It is.
Well, so let's start. You have a really incredible personal health journey. So let's start there and talk about that.
Yeah, I mean, I want to start off by saying that I've been blessed in my health. I've been healthy. I think we're at the margins of sort of what, it's not that it's not important. I just want to acknowledge that there are a lot of people out there who have legitimate real health problems. But I had, as a middle-aged man, put on weight. It's easier to see it in retrospect, looking back on photographs. But I had gained, you know, 20 or 25 pounds since college, probably. And, you know, you don't really notice it. Like, you don't feel it, other than, like, when clothes don't fit. And so it bothered me. It bothered me enough that I think, you know, 5 or 6 years ago, I started trying to play around with a form of intermittent fasting. So I started time-restricted eating. And I think I lost about 10 pounds. Over that time. And I've continued to do that mostly because I was just never hungry in the morning. And so it was easy for me to do. And so probably about 2 years ago, I was playing around. So I actually, 3 or 4 years ago, I joined the advisory board of a company based in San Francisco called Virta Health. And they use the ketogenic diet to help people with type 2 diabetes. That's what their core mission is. And I was really intrigued by the results that they were seeing in that population of people. But I also found that that nutrition approach seemed kind of weird to me. And I have a distinct memory of going to a dinner with the advisors one night at a Mexican restaurant. And we show up and they had, you know, like all the guacamole out in bowls and there were spoons, but no chips. And I leaned over to my seatmate, who was also not doing keto at the time, and I was like, this is weird. And I had that feeling for a long time, but ultimately ended up trying it. We had a prototype of this, you know, breath device that we ended up developing, and I was playing around with it. And for me, at least, at the beginning, I wasn't really trying to lose any weight. I was more just trying to see if I could get myself into ketosis as an experiment. And very rapidly over the period of, you know, 3 or 4 weeks, I lost a lot of weight. I lost probably 10 to 15 pounds in a month and started to feel different, like really different. And I mean, there were a few times, it's always hard to know, like, am I really feeling better or do I think I'm feeling better? But there were a few things that like were obvious and like, I don't think I could be fooling myself. The one that I talk about a lot is skiing. So skiing last winter was my first winter after I'd lost all this weight. I ended up losing about 20 pounds. Had to buy all new clothes. Like people thought I had cancer, which is scary. But once they figured out that I didn't have cancer, they all wanted to know what I was doing. But last year during ski season, it was like a whole different thing. I felt like I was, you know, 17.
Wow.
And you know, wasn't like limping around like an old man hunched over after skiing all day. So that was my journey. I mean, everything else looked good. I mean, it's funny because I'm a cardiologist, but I sort of am a minimalist when it comes to at least my own health. And so I don't check a lot of like blood work and stuff, but I decided to check last year just to see, to make sure everything was not out of whack. And it looked really good. All the numbers looked good. So, you know, I feel as good as I have since I was in high school, and, yeah, I'm happy. It's kind of good.
So in that process, you did two things. So intermittent fasting.
Yeah.
I'm curious. So like which there are multiple formats.
Yeah.
Overnight, yeah. 14 hours, 16:8, 18:6, 24, and everyone gets excited about autophagy,
yeah,
including myself. So talk a little bit about what you did there and what you do today and what the science is there.
Okay, so let me back up and say I spend a good chunk of my life in a research lab. I don't actually spend me physically there anymore. There are people there, but part of my responsibility is to run a research lab. I love science.
So do we.
Yeah, science is the greatest. But I also am very humble about connecting science and medicine. So, or connecting science and health. I think we make a lot of leaps that are probably unfounded. So autophagy is the perfect example. I love autophagy. I'll talk about TOR all day long. I'll talk about any component of the insulin signaling pathway all day long, but I'm not convinced yet that we have enough knowledge to be able to link what we're seeing in cells or even in mice or even other model systems with what's going on in our own health. So I like to wear these two hats, but I don't like to merge the two hats, which is kind of a funny thing. So I don't think about autophagy. I started doing 16-8. And the reason I was doing 16-8 was that I found that I wasn't really hungry in the morning. It wasn't hard to do, or it was less hard to do than I imagined it would be. I used to eat in the breakfast because my mom told me to eat breakfast. And
good son.
Well, I mean, you know, like everyone says, breakfast is the most important meal of the day. And I think it was one morning we were going to have a late brunch, and I figured, well, I don't want to ruin my brunch. I'm just going to wait. And I remember thinking, gosh, that was kind of easy, or it wasn't that hard to not eat until 1 o'clock. So I did that. And then I started thinking, well, I could do that. And I did that consistently and continue to do that now. It has subsequently become even easier now that I do keto, because I'm just really legitimately not hungry. It's a very different, even different thing now doing keto. So 16-8, and I actually have we're working on a randomized controlled trial that should be published or at least presented in the next couple of months comparing, it's in 150 people comparing 16-8 to 3 meals a day. Hmm. And we'll look at a bunch of outcomes, including obviously weight, but we'll look at a bunch of other things, body composition, energy expenditure, insulin, glucose, homeostasis, and things like that. And so we're excited to see that, because I think there's a lot of excitement about fasting in general, but there's still not quite the evidence basis yet to support it.
Is there anything you've seen where there's potentially a greater benefit as duration increases? So 18, 20, some people do the 36 every once in a while.
Yeah, I mean, there are people who do longer. I mean, I know people who do 1 week fast. I have one patient of mine who says he has the funniest practice. He will fast for 1 week doing nothing but water. On Sunday of that fast, he'll have a steak and a glass of red wine, and then he'll fast for another week.
Whoa.
Yeah. It's a bizarre thing. But there are people who do all kinds of things. Look, there's nothing yet other than anecdote other than like somebody's experiments in cells or in mice to support that there's a benefit to humans. But I'll say it's one of the things that we can control ourselves without somebody like me as a doctor writing a prescription. So it's empowering. And I think
it's free.
Yeah. And if people want to do
it, you're not eating as much.
It's also easy, right? I mean, that's the other thing, or relatively easy, right? There's nothing complicated. There's no, like, you don't have to measure, you know, track your calories or your macros or anything. It's a simple thing. The other thing that I love about it is that it sort of reverses, or at least potentially addresses, one of the core problems I think we as human beings have evolved out of from our ancestors, which is we eat all the time, not when food is available, right? It used to be that you would eat when you'd have food, and that's very different, right? We didn't evolve in an environment where there were refrigerators and preservatives. So our ancestors ate when they could get food. So I think one of the things that we've done is to condition ourselves not to tolerate hunger very well. So to me, one of the biggest benefits of my practice of intermittent fasting is to learn how to be hungry again. And it's something I talk about with my kids all the time, because my kids will come home from school and they'll say, I'm starving. And I'll say, are you really starving?
Or are you dehydrated?
Well, I said, let's just be clear on what that word means. Are you what do you mean by that? And they say, I'm starving. I'm going to die. And so I love to tell them, it's probably the 100th time I've said this publicly, but I love to ask them sort of, what is your, what do you believe? When will you actually die if you don't eat? And their answer is, I don't know, soon, in the next couple of hours.
How old are your kids?
16 and 13. And I'll ask them, and they still don't believe it. I'll say, what is the longest period of time that a human being has lived without any food? And they'll be 6 hours. I mean, And when I tell them it's 300 and something days, they just don't even believe it. So it's so I think one of the things that I, for me personally, that's been empowering about the intermittent fasting is that I know that my hunger, while it feels like at sometimes it's linear, So if you get hungry, that it's going to keep going up, 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 that it actually doesn't. It's there are peaks and valleys. And so it'll come up and it'll come back down and you can actually move through it. Now, I've never done a super long fast. I fasted before. So I turned 50 this year and I had a colonoscopy. And so I fasted for probably 40 hours before that. And I probably could have kept going, but I also was like, I don't really,
right.
I'm not sure what the purpose of this is. So, yeah.
So you also mentioned keto earlier, which is, you know, we talk about science and there's a lot of studies, I think, happening, but most, I think a lot of it with regards to diabetes and more of a disease management, if you will. How has your thinking around keto evolved since a couple of years ago?
Yeah. I mean, so for one, my personal experience combined with the data that I see coming out, and I'll acknowledge that the data we have is still not perfect, although is there perfect nutrition data anywhere? And the answer to that question is obviously no.
I think you should say that again.
Yeah. Is there perfect nutrition data anywhere? No, there is not. I think we're the quality of the data in nutrition science is poor. We all know that. It, unfortunately, in the words of Don Rumsfeld, my favorite quote of all,
unfortunately.
So for people out there who don't know who Donald Rumsfeld is, he was the defense secretary under George Bush II. And he had a quote that I love, which was, this was during the Iraq War, and he was getting questioned by reporters about, like, you know, the quality of the army or this and that. And he said, you go to war with the army you have, not the army you want. And so I apply that to nutrition science, right? I would love to have more science.
Very appropriate, because it feels like a war.
It is nutrition a little bit. Yes, yeah, it is a little bit of a war. So for me personally, looking at the data and then my own experience led me to, I think conclude that there's something there. There's clearly something there on the diabetes side. I think that's been fairly well established. And even the sort of most ardent critics, I think, will acknowledge that. I think there's something there on the weight loss side. The mechanisms of sort of how keto leads to weight loss, I think, are hotly debated. And when it comes to nutrition wars, that's kind of one of the biggest ones. And I try to stay out of it. I think I'll let them figure it out. I think we can all agree it does lead to weight loss. My guess is that the bulk of that effect comes from the appetite suppressing effects, that I think you just end up eating less. Whether there's a benefit in terms of energy expenditure or something else, I don't know. And whether there's a benefit of ketones themselves, I don't know. So I have come to really love and practice keto myself and recommend it to patients. And I've started a company around it. But I was left with sort of this one, I think, conundrum that bothered me. And we can talk about that at some point too.
Yeah. So let's talk about your personal approach to keto and what that looks like in a day in the life, which is a more plant-based approach, which is something we're big believers in Mind Body Green. It was one of our trends. And then I want to talk about the company that you got two amazing products that I love and we'll talk about, but let's talk about the plant-based approach. And
yeah. So maybe we should back up and say, I think my perception of keto, probably based on sort of its earlier life as the Atkins diet, was that keto equals bacon and butter and steak and lard, right? I mean, I think if you sort of did like a thought bubble, like, and you ask somebody, what is keto? Those are the words that would pop up, or the foods that would pop up.
Sure.
And so I think most of us didn't appreciate that you can do keto without that. And so why is that important? Well, the reason for me as a cardiologist it's important is that one of the sort of things that we have seen and one of the things that concerned me the most about keto, and it was something that came up during the era of Atkins and, you know, was the effect on lipids or cholesterol. And I, as a cardiologist, am not in the camp of dismissing the value or importance of cholesterol. I think that cholesterol is one of, if not the most important risk factors for coronary artery disease, for heart attacks, which remains the biggest cause of death in the world. So I'm not ready to dismiss the importance of cholesterol, of blood cholesterol. I will acknowledge that keto diets lead to many other benefits. And in fact, I think one of the sort of areas of cognitive dissonance for people in whom this happens is that they'll say, well, I lost all this weight, all of my markers got better, my insulin, my glucose, my, you know, triglycerides went down, my HDL went up, everything looked great. But there's this one sort of nagging thing, which is my LDL cholesterol, my bad cholesterol went up. And that story gets told again and again, and it's probably anywhere between 20 and 40% of people who do conventional high saturated fat keto diets that have that. And so it's been an area that's sort of been incredibly ripe for discussion slash argument slash war. But I'm not ready to buy into the fact that all those other benefits offset the problems with LDL. And so we started thinking a lot about, well, what could you do? Is there a way to do keto where you wouldn't get that? Could you get all the good without the bad?
Sure.
And so for me, I started experimenting with this sort of heavily plant-based and fish. So I'm not a vegetarian. I'm not a vegan. I have experimented with doing vegan keto for a week, and it's definitely doable, but it's probably not for me long-term. So I started playing around with what happens if you take away, you know, if you replace olive oil with, or sorry, if you replace butter with olive oil, you eat, you know, you get your fats mostly from avocado, from nuts, from fatty fish, if you're, you know, eat that kind of, if you eat meat. And the result of that was that it looked like that, for me at least, appears to be the convergence of all the good without the bad. Like that's, and I've had a few patients anecdotally who've had wonderful experiences where they had these like skyrocketing LDL cholesterols, who changed their diet from sort of predominantly, you know, meat and saturated fat and butter, and to, you know, avocado, olive oil, olives, nuts, and salmon. And they've had, you know, very good changes in their lipids. So it's something that I'm excited about. We will test it formally, but it's something I'm really excited about.
I'm one of those people that started to happen to me when I started to go a little bit in the wrong direction. So I'm curious personally, like, what does a day in the life look like for you in terms of what do you eat?
Yeah, simple. I have a cup of black coffee in the morning.
Still good.
I love black coffee.
Still good.
I tell my partners and anyone else who will listen to me that there were two non-negotiables in my nutrition journey. And so anything that I would develop and promote or believe in had to have two things. One of them is coffee and the other one is wine. So I couldn't support anything where I wouldn't be able to. People said, well, you can't drink. And I said, no, of course you can drink.
Red wine or is all wine?
I think, you know, like I prefer red wine, but I don't think there's a big difference. I mean, the amount of carbohydrate in a glass of dry white wine is the same as it is in a glass of, you know, dry red wine. So, and then lunch for me is a salad. I think one of the big changes for me on my personal journey was that instead of going and buying lunch every day at Subway or at a food truck, and eating a burrito or eating, you know, whatever it was that was there, whatever crap was there. One of the benefits of doing keto was that it's not really easy to find food in places, like, you know, when you go out to have lunch. And so I started bringing my own lunch. I would make a salad every day. I continue to do that now. I've been doing that for almost 2 years. And so my salad is, you know, some form of lettuce, whatever's in the house. So arugula or, you know, kale or whatever it is, and then chopped vegetables, celery, cucumbers, peppers. My good friend Carrie Diulis, who's I know somebody you know well, introduced me to these lupini beans, which are extremely high in fiber and have zero net carbs. And so I'll throw them into my salad. I'll throw
lupini beans,
yeah, and they're awesome because, you know, again, fiber is another consideration, right? That people on conventional ketogenic diets don't typically get a lot of fiber. So it's great if you can find sources of fiber that don't also have a lot of carbohydrates. So lupini beans, and then a whole avocado every day, whole avocado, nuts, usually macadamia or walnuts, which are my favorite. And then I will either throw a protein if it's, you know, leftover salmon from the night before, or some tofu, or occasionally I'll just not have it. I'll get enough from the rest. And then I keep in my office a cabinet full of olive oil, and I douse my salad in olive oil. And that's my lunch every day. Occasionally I'll throw some cheese on there depending on how I feel. And then dinner is really just a roasted vegetable. It's either, you know, call it something non-starchy. So broccoli, cauliflower, Brussels sprouts, asparagus, and then some protein, usually, you know, fish or tofu or something like that, depending on what's going on. And our house is weird because my wife and I are both doing keto. My younger daughter is a vegetarian, really a pescatarian. And my older daughter is basically loves meat. So it can be hard to kind of make the Venn diagram circles overlap. So we often are making a few meals.
So where I was going next is protein. So it sounds like your favorite source personally is fish.
Fish. Wild, I love fish. Wild. Yeah. I mean, I try as much as I can for both, you know, ethical and health reasons to have fine wild caught, you know, wild caught fish. I'm not perfect.
How do you rank your fish? Do you subscribe to Smash?
No, I don't. I should actually. I should. I'll have to get that for me.
So it's like the salmon, yeah. Mackerel,
yeah.
Anchovy,
yeah.
Sardines, yeah. And herring.
Okay. I mean, those are basically the ones I would eat.
Right.
I would eat tuna if it's, you know, if you can confirm it's not, you know, doesn't have a lot of mercury. And if it's, you know, sustainably caught, it's a hard place to be. It's really hard because I think if you could pick like an ideally healthy protein source from animals, if you're a person who does eat animals, fish is the best. But, you know, there are all these problems, right? There's the sort of sustainability issues. There's the
mercury
issues. So, but that's my, you know, go-to. I'll have salmon 5 or 7 times a week.
So as a cardiologist, personally, what's your take on eggs and then chicken?
So it's a great question. I think, you know, look, the bottom line on eggs for me is that the effect, unless you're one of these people who's eating 20 eggs a day or something crazy, I think the effect size of any negative impact of eggs on health, if there is one, is small. I think the reason we see, you know, it's almost like a weekly new study saying that eggs will kill you or eggs are going to make you live forever. The reason we see this bouncing ping pong ball back and forth is because people are focusing on the conclusion and not on the magnitude of the effect size. So I do eat eggs. I don't like love eggs and I don't eat them every day, but I will eat eggs. I'll have an omelet. You know, if I'm going to have breakfast with my family on a weekend, I'll have an omelet. Or if there's nothing in the refrigerator, I come home from work one night and I'm hungry, I'll have an omelet. So I definitely will eat eggs. There are some people in whom it does like cause crazy cholesterol responses. And I think those are people probably that should pay attention. But for me, it didn't seem to impact them.
And what about chicken?
I do eat chicken. I don't eat a ton of chicken, but I do eat, I will eat chicken. I have a couple of recipes that I actually really love. And I had chicken last night for dinner. So, yeah.
So you have it. It's,
I will have it. Yeah.
Do you view it as, I've heard some people say it's like chicken's neutral, chicken can depend on the individual. For some people it could elevate, you know, it's.
Yeah. I mean, there was an interesting study that came out this summer from one of my good friends and colleagues, Ron Krause, who's at, in Oakland, and he's one of the sort of fathers of lipidology. And his study suggested that it didn't matter what kind of protein, it didn't matter whether you were eating red meat or white meat from chicken, that it was really the animal protein itself that had the impact on cholesterol and lipids. As much as I love Ron, I'm not really sure I'm ready to go there yet. I still think that there is an impact of the amount of and quality of saturated fat. And again, for me, my principles in nutrition are I'll eat almost anything a little bit.
Sure.
Like I'm not gonna, I don't have an ethical, like, you know, I don't have a big, strong ethical thing. The one thing I don't eat, and we don't need to like get into details of why, but I personally don't eat beef, and I haven't eaten beef in 20 years.
Got it. I was going to ask you that next. Like, do you ever touch red meat?
I occasionally will have some, I mean, once a month I'll have lamb or pork, literally once a month, but I don't eat cow.
Got it. And
it's not religious and it's not really health. It's more kind of a random like story that happened 20 years ago. So.
Got it. So as a cardiologist, what are the tests? You know, I think most people, they go to their doctor and they get like the, you know, if it's a traditional Western doctor, it's like they do like the standard kind of tests. But like, in your opinion, what are some of the more, like, I think everyone gets cholesterol, blood pressure, like what are some of the more progressive testing that someone should do if they're concerned about, you know, developing heart disease?
Yeah. It depends a little bit on who that person is and what their risk is. There is some really compelling evidence from human genetics. So what we don't have in cardiology are studies that last longer than 5 years. That's the nature of the business. We have observational studies that last a lot longer, but those are highly flawed and very hard to interpret. So the best, I think, evidence we have relating to all this comes from human genetics, which are sort of experiments of nature. And I think the net of that is that it seems to be that the lifelong exposure to some of these, what people call atherogenic lipids. So these are lipids that cause plaque or plaque buildup or blockages of the arteries and eventually lead to heart attacks, that it's the lifetime exposure to these kinds of lipids that matters. And so there is some evidence to support intervening earlier or discovering earlier and potentially intervening earlier, either with lifestyle and or medical therapy, despite the fact that there are no trials to support that. And it's an area where, you know, I now practice differently than I did 10 years ago when I was trained in this very sort of hardcore traditional Western evidence-based medicine approach, which is if there's no trial, it doesn't exist. I think my patients don't respond to that. I think and it's unfortunately the reality is if we wait around for the trials for some of these things, we're all going to be dead. Now, does that sort of give you free rein to do anything? No, of course not. We have to be humble. And so for me, any intervention that I would think about that's unsupported by a trial, it would have to be really low risk. And so that's how I think about it. So in terms of the tests, I don't want to dismiss the value of cholesterol and blood pressure because those are probably the two most important.
They're leading into it. There's something happening.
They're really important. And so I think those are the two kind of most important. And blood pressure is blood pressure. I think the only thing I'll say is that so blood pressure varies a lot throughout the day and between the day and between different days. And some people have a spike in blood pressure because of coffee. So one blood pressure is probably not adequate. So I think, get a few blood pressures. For cholesterol, the traditional lipid profile that you would get if you went to your doctor would include total cholesterol, HDL triglycerides, and they would calculate this LDL cholesterol through a formula, which is very simple. And 5 years ago, I thought, well, that's all we need. And then somewhere around 5 years ago, I started to think, well, there's probably more we can learn. And so I started adopting a little bit more of a detailed approach to looking at the lipids. So for one, I added an Lp(a), especially in people who were higher risk or had a family history. Lp(a) is a different sort of form of a lipid, but it's been associated, very highly associated.
That was a great, Bob Harper, Anna Hot O'Connor wrote a great piece about LPA and Bob Harper, like a guy who looks fit, looks great, but wait, this one thing over here.
Yeah. And that story gets told again and again, and it's often in younger men, and you'll see this over and over again. And people, if they've gotten a calcium scan and their lipids look good, you can almost predict that this is, if they have high calcium in their arteries, that it's going to be because of Lp(a). So I still will get an Lp(a). I probably get it in most patients I see, but that's sort of a biased sample because of the people that I see in my practice as a preventive cardiologist. I also started getting a little bit more detailed in the lipids, and I would do these advanced lipid profiles, whereas I used to dismiss them and think this is worthless. So I'd look at sort of not just the basic lipid profile that I described before, but I'd look at, either ion mobility or some NMR spectroscopy to look at the different size of LDL particles.
Particle size,
Particle number, and then apolipoprotein B. So ApoB is this protein that carries around lipid, and that one is probably the most highly implicated as a bad actor. And you can measure that now in blood almost anywhere, and it's cheap. Whereas these other, like the particle size is pretty expensive, but ApoB is like $15. So I did one of these like boomerang things where I went from kind of being a minimalist to ordering all this stuff to now doing less again, except in certain people. I think the particle size, and I've been thinking a lot about this over the last year, the particle size is interesting. It's the most impacted by nutrition. And I think it's, I will order it from time to time in people, especially if we're going to make a nutrition change. But I think what is, I would say, sort of my basic panel besides blood pressure and regular lipids, is an ApoB and an Lp(a). I think that's probably sufficient. And if you really, really wanted to, you could get the same or close to the same knowledge by just taking the original basic lipid profile and looking not at LDL cholesterol, but looking at non-HDL cholesterol, which is basically the total cholesterol minus the HDL. And so in some ways, basically, what I tell people is that non-HDL in populations is relatively equal to ApoB, which is relatively equal to LDL particle number. All three of those tend to give about the same information in populations, not always in individuals.
Got it. So something else, when you think of heart disease, and people will talk about this, I think I don't know if this is real or just an anecdote that so many heart attacks occur Monday morning at 9 a.m.
Yeah.
Stress.
It's not an anecdote. And there was actually some beautiful work done by a guy, I think his name is Jim Muller. This is back in the 1980s, on stress and the relationship to that as a trigger for heart attacks. There have been natural experiments, I think, looking at like cities.
Natural experiment. Let's put them in a room and yell at them.
No, but you can't. No, but there are some naturally stressful experiments of the world's in world history. So I think after earthquakes, or I think after like World Cup losses, there are certain countries where like the rate of heart attacks spikes in like a non-trivial way after the team lost the World Cup. Or after a big earthquake. These are like, you know, now established. So there's no doubt that stress is important as a heart attack trigger. Stress, extreme emotional stress, can also cause a different form of heart disease that's called broken heart syndrome, which is basically your heart can weaken, usually temporarily, but like it happens a lot in people who've lost a spouse or have gone under some other extreme emotional stress. That, like I said, is usually reversible. But there's no doubt that stress itself, probably through cortisol or other, you know, hormones that we don't completely appreciate, will increase your risk to trigger a heart attack.
What have you seen for, it seems like we're in generation anxiety.
Yeah.
Everyone's stressed. What have you seen that works for people?
I don't have an answer to that other than what works for you works for you. The one thing
I'll, or you personally.
Well, so I don't really, I'm a Luddite, like or maybe that's the wrong word. I don't practice. Like I wish, my wife is a huge yoga fanatic. Like she has this teacher she follows around like a, you know, like she's like a teenager chasing after like Justin Timberlake. It's,
which teacher?
I can't remember her name, but she's at some studio in San Francisco. Okay. My wife literally, I mean, and our whole family will organize our weekly schedule around my wife being able to go to her yoga. It's impacts the family in positive and negative ways. Negative ways if she can't go. She's been trying to convince me to go for years. It hasn't been my thing. I have like my own sort of weird practices of meditation that are probably not meditation. I'll like close my eyes at work for 15 minutes and maybe
meditate. That's a form of mindfulness.
Yeah. But, you know, personally, I don't do too much. The one thing I do, this is going to sound weird, the one thing that I emphasize internally and also with my friends and family and with my patients is that sometimes I find that people are anxious about their anxiety. Sure. And that it's the same thing with sleep or other things, that they'll come to me and say, I need to do something to reduce my anxiety. And I'll say, well, do you feel that way? Or do you feel that way because somebody made you feel that way? And they'll say, well, I just feel like I have too much stress. And I said, well, don't stress about having stress. Like one thing you can start by doing is just don't stress about the fact that you have stress. You don't want to have double jeopardy, right? Don't punish yourself for the fact that you're feeling stressed. And that can somewhat alleviate a little bit of it.
So with regards to anxiety, you know, we talk about generation anxiety. It's my point of view and what the science says, but I think science is starting to support this as technology plays a role.
No doubt.
You're in the belly of the beast of the valley. No doubt. What's your thought there?
Yeah. I mean, I remember as an intern, when my pager would go off, I would have like a dreadful like pit in my stomach. If I were measuring cortisol, I'm sure I'd have a cortisol surge. And anytime I would hear that noise, you know, I finished my internship in 1996. So anytime I would hear that noise for 10 years after that, I would have that same like Pavlovian response. And it probably took 10 years to get rid of it. And the same thing now happens when I hear a text go off. Like it's the same thing. And it's funny because we have this yellow lab who's like got extraordinary anxiety. And literally we have had to turn off all sound notifications in our house because he will like jump into bed with us if he hears a text go off. He goes crazy. And so we don't have any notifications. But if I'm out with somebody and their text goes off, like I jump. This stuff can't be good. I mean, I'm terrible. My wife will like to say that I'm one of the worst in terms of my attachment to my phone. It's something I aspire to fix without making it, you know, again, a source of great stress that I'm stressing about using my phone too much. But I think we're all like bombarded by all this stuff way too much. I aspire to be the guy who, like, I'll take the dog out for a long walk on the weekends, and I aspire to be the person who can leave my phone behind. I haven't yet been able to do that.
Well, one of our other trends is happening in the valley called dopamine fasting.
Right. Look, I mean, the few times in my recent history where I have not been connected, I've come back feeling so renewed and energized and connected, like connected to the world, to the universe. And I keep thinking like, this is a lesson. And, you know, every time that happens for 3 or 4 days or 5 or a week, I'll, you know, kind of find my phone gross. But of course, then life interferes and like you sure. have it, it comes back again. So I don't know how to sustain it. I don't know how we can fix it. Now, of course, I do worry about our kids. I think it's, you know, our kids are like so ridiculously connected to these things that we didn't have. I mean, they just can't even understand the fact that we didn't have these devices.
Sure. So something else you mentioned earlier was sleep.
Right.
Yeah. How important is sleep?
Well, again, you know, based on like scientific evidence, I can't tell you that it's like, you know, going to kill you if you don't sleep. I think we all logically believe that it's like really important. And I think people can tell their own anecdotal experiences of what happens to, say, blood sugar control or other things if they don't sleep. And Carrie probably could tell you endlessly about what happens to her blood sugar control if she doesn't sleep. It's important. It's really important. And it's another one of these things where I hope people won't punish themselves if they are struggling with it. Like I don't want it to be a compounded thing where if you're having trouble sleeping that you're then anxious about not sleeping. I mean, I think I'm blessed to be able to sleep anywhere. I could sleep upside down on my head in a loud, crowded room and have no trouble. So it's a little bit harder for me, but I know it's like one of the biggest things that I talk about with my patients is their difficulty in sleeping. How much of that is related to things that we can control? So, you know, alcohol, stress, you know, caffeine, things like that, other sleep hygiene related things. I don't know how much of it is just biology. I don't know how much of it is anxiety. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know, but it is an area that I think is ripe. I think we're getting better at tracking sleep. So there are lots of devices that can tell you how your sleep is. Yeah. The problem we're missing right now is that those things don't have actionable information yet, right? There's not a program that says, okay, well, your sleep is shit. So we should, like, here's what you should do to fix it. We're still stuck in this, like, it's information, but there's no solution yet.
Yeah, for me personally, and I wear a Fitbit, I track steps because I've just always liked tracking steps. I love walking. I love, you know, that's my exercise on many days. With sleep, I joke, like, I know if I have a bad night's sleep, I know if I have a good one, so I don't want to be reminded of it.
Yeah, I wore an Oura Ring for a while and basically stopped wearing it because I would wake up every morning and then I'd be anxious about, like, it says I got no deep sleep and yet I kind of feel fine. So wait, what's real? And so for me, ultimately, again, I don't have a problem sleeping. So it was sort of like not the most valuable thing for me.
So in many ways, I feel like we're in the golden age of well-being. New studies, and again, studies aren't perfect. Science is perfect, but one of the things we talk about here is this idea of connecting soul and science. So, you know, people validating things like acupuncture works and meditation, and then some things over here are a little bit of a reach with regards to nutrition or what have you. So, in your opinion, like what are some of the most exciting developing, if you will, studies or something recent that's come out that's really interesting and exciting to you?
Yeah, I mean, I spend the majority of my time thinking about nutrition just because that's what I do. and so, you know, I think it's exciting that we're sort of on the precipice of actually having real, and I won't call them like gold standard, but real science coming in areas, in the two areas that I think about the most, which is sort of when do you eat and what do you eat? Again, every one of these questions should be framed with
sort of. I like that. It's quite simple. And if you think about it, that's what it is.
It is.
What and when.
And then to me, the most important thing is to think about how you frame what your goals are. So if you're, you know, way overweight and you have type 2 diabetes, you may have a different set of goals than if you're, you know, 31-year-old, you know, man who's got a BMI of 22 and is, you know, there are different goals for different people. And so I think one of the things to do is to start to begin to frame these questions in that context. And so I think there's some cool science coming in both of these areas. I'm excited, obviously, about learning more about the sort of real benefits or harms or neutrality of, you know, all versions of time-restricted eating, intermittent fasting. I think we'll find out. There's a lot at the American Diabetes Association meeting, which was in San Francisco last year, and I was on the planning commission. So I went to a ton of sessions. By far the best attended session, I mean, by far, was the intermittent fasting session. It was literally the room, which was like 750 people, was full. The overflow room which was 750 people, was full. And there was a third overflow room, and it was crazy. The energy in there was amazing. So I think that that's one area where we'll see more and more better science sort of on the question of when do you eat. And lots of interesting things about, you know, different forms of fasting. And then within sort of, you know, let's say it's 16:8, what is the best time to eat versus what's the best time to fast?
Well, so, also the differences between men and women there.
Tons. And then, you know, in the what you eat thing, there's going to be the continued diet wars. I think it's probably safe to say that we have some consensus. I am a consensus building person. I hate conflict. And so I try to find common ground. So I think one thing that we probably all can agree on, whether you're in the sort of staunchly, you know, sort of low fat vegan world, or whether you're in the, you know, carnivore world, I think one thing that we can mostly agree on are three principles. And I think these three principles will probably stick around for the foreseeable future. So one of them is to limit our intake of processed food. And there was a beautiful study by Kevin Hall recently, which showed the impact of processed food. He's working on that, you know, again and again. And I think
I saw that.
Yeah.
And so it was, it didn't even matter where you fell on the diet spectrum, whether you were vegan or carnivore.
It did.
The processed food was the bad thing there.
Right. And it makes sense, right? I mean, Skittles are vegan, right?
Yes.
Doritos, I think, are probably vegan. Maybe there's cheese on them, but you get the idea. Like it, you can eat crappy food that's vegan. You can eat crappy food that's keto or carnivore. So I think processed food, limiting our intake of processed food to the extent that we can. And I think this
fits. Life happens.
Yeah. But that's the other part of this is like, it's stress. Don't stress about the fact if you're hungry, you're in an airport and you can't find something to eat. Like, eat.
I have a bar.
Yeah.
I travel with bars
don't
everywhere.
Go, yeah. So the second principle is to limit our intake of added sugar. I think, you know, again, no matter where you fall on the spectrum, I think adding sugar to things has, you know, there's evidence just as what happened with the tobacco industry that they were, you know, intentionally trying to addict people to tobacco. I think the similar evidence is now building. A colleague of mine at UCSF uncovered papers, the sugar papers, similar to tobacco papers, that where they were trying to addict people to sugar. So I think adding sugar to things unnecessarily is probably something we can agree on. Doesn't mean you can't have birthday cake, right? Have birthday cake and don't feel guilty about it. And then the third thing is refined carbohydrates. I think that one, you know, maybe there's a little bit less consensus on, but that's one area where I think we probably can find some consensus is, you know, if you're going to have carbohydrates, it's probably best to have them in the sort of their natural state and to the extent that you can.
Like sweet potatoes.
Yeah. Sweet potatoes versus, you know, regular potatoes, you know, I don't know, maybe like instead of pasta and bread, you know, vegetables.
So it's funny you brought up just carbohydrates in general. We had a guest on here, RD, Maya Feller, and she was like, this is like the biggest catch-all category. If you think about it,
yeah.
Within carbohydrates, there's good, there's bad, there's ugly. And it's just, you can't just say carbs.
You can't. Well, and that's the thing. I think, you know, that's why, you know, you'll hear in the keto world, you'll hear the term net carbs all the time. And some people are turned off by that and some people aren't. I actually like it. I think there needs to be a better word for it to make it more understandable for people. But the idea behind net carbs is you're subtracting out the dietary fiber. So in other words, like if there's, I don't even off the top of my head, don't know, but if there's 30 grams of carbohydrates in a serving of broccoli, that's not the same as 30 grams of carbohydrates in an apple.
Sure.
There's different, there's much less sugar in the broccoli than there is in the apple. So I think, I think we're learning that the carbohydrate that comes in a fiber form is neutral, if not good for you. So I tell people, don't even think about when, you know, how much you eat of that, you know, sort of non-starchy fibrous vegetables.
Do you have a favorite personally?
I mean, I literally could eat broccoli, cauliflower, asparagus or Brussels sprouts every day. I probably do have them almost every day. Love them.
I love roasted cauliflower, yeah. Roasted Brussels sprouts and broccoli, like with like just drenched in olive oil.
Yeah.
Could do that all day.
I love it. I discovered this, like, I don't know if I saw, I mean, it's not even really a recipe, but I discovered that you could take a whole cauliflower head, put it in a small cast iron skillet and just drench it, literally saturate it with olive oil. And stick it in a hot grill. So just, you know, like a, and leave it there for like 35 minutes and it comes out like brown and perfect and like butter on the inside. It's amazing.
You guys should go after this. There's a restaurant called the Osprey at the One Hotel, which is in the park. It's beautiful, but they do exactly that.
Oh, great. So I didn't discover it. All right, perfect.
So if you could look into your crystal ball, what do you think we're going to be talking about in a year from now or 2 years from now?
Well, we're still going to be talking about the same things because we've been talking about the same things for a long time. I am hopeful that we'll be talking more in a more informed way. I'm hopeful that there will be more science. I think we're still probably going to be talking about these same basic questions. You know, what do you eat and when do you eat and what are your goals and what is the evidence that it's going to make you healthier or live longer or reduce your risk of disease? I hope that we can get to a point where we don't spend our lives thinking about all this stuff all the time. I do think it somewhat detracts. I'm always fond of saying that life is short and we should enjoy it. And so we don't want to spend our entire lives obsessing about all this stuff. We should probably be spending more time connecting with other people and doing the things we love. Some people love this and they should keep talking. I love it. I'll talk about it.
It's why I'm a big fan of Dan Buettner and Blue Zones.
Okay.
Emotional connection.
Yeah.
Just like,
Not
thinking about it too much, enjoying life. Breaking bread with friends and family, having wine.
Breaking keto bread.
Yeah, exactly. Breaking keto bread. But like this idea of enjoying life, I've often said here, if you're at a birthday party and you're stressing about not eating the cake, I would argue that not eating the cake and stressing about it is worse than just enjoying the cake at the birthday party.
I agree.
You shouldn't go to a birthday party every night.
Yes.
But
now I will say we still live in a food environment that is challenging for a lot of people. So Carrie and I were walking through the airport yesterday and it's just a bombardment of smells and sights. And you know, it's like Dunkin' Donuts and
Cinnabon,
Annie's. One after another. And that's an area where I think we really have a lot of room to improve.
Yeah. Well, it's at the same time, like Dunkin', like a lot of those, like some of those companies, Dunkin', like they're trying to change.
They are.
They're trying to figure it out. They know they have a problem. They know they need to do better and they're trying.
Yeah, and I don't want to get into the whole alternate fake meat controversy, which I've grown very tired of. But the fact that Burger King, and I don't know if McDonald's is doing it too, the fact that they have embraced, an impossible burger, to me is a good thing. And and again, we can argue about whether it's a healthy thing or it's good for the environment, all this. But the fact is that they're responding to something. They're not doing this for their health. No. They're doing it because people are demanding it in the marketplace.
And I think everyone would agree it's better than like crappy conventional meat.
Yeah. Especially the meat that they're serving.
Yeah. And it was interesting. There was an article in the Journal months ago while Beyond Meat exploded in the stock market. Essentially, there were some interviews with people who were excited about this, about going to Burger King and trying the Impossible Burger and Beyond and so forth. It had nothing to do with health. They thought it was cool.
Yeah.
It was cool and interesting.
And there are people out there like my kid who, is 13 years old and is basically a pescatarian. If we're going somewhere and somebody, her sister has a hamburger, she's feels left out. And so now she can, again, independent of any of the health benefits, she feels more of a connection to the people she's eating with because she can eat one too. So I see that as a good thing.
No, it's cool. I'm with you. So I'll close with, last question, you and Carrie. Have an exciting startup, Keto, K-E-Y-T-O. And let's talk about that. You've got a couple exciting products that personally I'm interested in because whenever I travel, I have bars. And we have a three-year-old and we like better-for-you cereal options. Yeah. So those are two I'm excited about. But let's talk about the inspiration for that and what you guys are launching.
Yeah, so the company was started basically, have these two amazing co-founders. They had been working in this space for a long time. They had started a company they ultimately sold to Weight Watchers that was a social network for weight loss. People would post, it was like an Instagram feed.
What was the name of the company?
It was called Waylos.
Okay.
And they were acquired by Weight Watchers. They worked there for a few years.
It's WWE.
Yeah. And so, and I had been working with this other company, Virta, and seen the benefits that they were having in this sort of sicker population of people with advanced type 2 diabetes, but really amazing results. And to me, the most sort of striking of those results were the people were coming off their diabetes medications. That's just not seen anywhere except in people who've had bariatric surgery. So the fact that you can intervene in a group of people and you see them coming off of their diabetes medications, including insulin, is amazing. So I thought, well, wow, this is such a cool thing, but it's pretty expensive and not accessible yet to an average person who may not be quite that sick, who may want to just optimize their health or their weight. So we thought about sort of how we could build a a similar product without all the human intervention, which is what drives the cost, and stumbled onto this idea that, you know, one of the things about the keto diet, independent of all of its other benefits that it offers that's unique among diets, is that it offers you a fast and trackable biomarker that allows you to know how you're doing on a real, in a relatively real-time basis, which is you can measure your ketones mm-hmm. in breath or blood or urine. And so we developed this breath device, which really is designed for to help people engage, do this diet for the purpose of, you know, health or wellness and weight loss. And so we launched that product last year. It's been super successful. But then we thought, okay, well, in addition to giving people information about how they're doing and enabling them to do better, what else do they need? So last year, we basically launched this app, which gives them all the resources they need. It gives them a searchable database of food. So if you're at a restaurant, you want to know, well, how many net carbs are there in an apple? You can punch an apple, or you can punch in salmon, or any food in, out there. And recipes. Carrie helped us launch an entirely plant-based version. So if you want to do a vegan keto, plant-based keto, you can do that now through our app. So we have recipes, we have meal plans, other resources, and fun things in the app. But the third thing that we thought was like going to be critical is not just sort of knowing how you're doing and knowing what to do or what not to do, but actually having the food in front of you. And I mentioned earlier that for me, going to, you know, at lunch, it was challenging to find food that I could eat. And so we sort of decided, you know what, this is the time in this life cycle of this whole thing when we're going to have to make foods that we believe in. So we're launching our own foods. We're going to do some of our own with like heavy hardcore R&D. And the first two of those are bars and cereals. Those are two things that people are going to eat.
Yes.
And you know, if you're hungry and you're rushing and you can't stop and have lunch, you should not have a panic attack about that. You should be able to eat something. And so we've developed really, really clean bars. So our bars, which will, I think we'll launch them on a crowdfunding campaign in January or so. They are going to have, so they're entirely plant-based. So they'll have, the ingredients are very simple, basically almonds, almond bits, almond butter, olive oil, some allulose. I mean, it's really incredibly clean. And thanks to Carrie, we know they don't spike your blood sugar, and they are very low in net carbs, so 3 grams of net carbs, low in calories, so 200 calories. And they taste really nice. So excited about that. Super excited about cereal. You mentioned the kid thing. So one thing that my kids, you know, as I've been on my personal journey, both doing it, but also launching this company, my kids have grown quite tired of trying my different keto foods. they are not keto themselves, and they're basically, it's almost like a Pavlovian response that they immediately think this is going to taste like crap if I give them something. But these products have passed my kids' test, which is pretty unusual and amazing. And to me, that tells me that these things taste good enough that you will have a hard time noticing the difference. And you may even find the taste better than you would just an average like Clif Bar or something, which is going to have however many, you know, hundreds of grams of sugar or whatever it is. So we're excited about both those areas. We have a few other ideas coming. But the key idea is to be able to give people options if they want to find, you know, things like this without all this extra added sugar and with a moderate amount of carbohydrate.
I love it. Well, please continue to send samples for taste testing. By way, I'm all in.
Well, I'll get you the samples of the cereal as soon as we get them, because it's pretty good.
Awesome. Yeah. Well, so great. Congratulations. Thanks for being here, Ethan.
Thank you so much, Jason. It's great.